I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Malala Yousafzai was returning from school in the Swat Valley in Pakistan on October 9th when a Taliban gunman shot her point blank. She was first taken to a military hospital and flown this week to a trauma facility in Britain for more treatment. Two of her classmates were shot, although their injuries were less serious. 14-year-old Malala has been an outspoken proponent of girls' education in her country and a critic of the Taliban that had closed and destroyed schools and threatened the population. They said they shot her because of her activism and will target her again because of her, quote, Western thinking. Our guest, Adam Elick, made a documentary, Class Dismissed, in 2009 that featured Malala and her father as her school was being shut down by the Taliban. Here's Malala talking about her determination to get an education.
They cannot stop me. I will get my education if it is in home, school, or any place. This is our request to the all world there to save our school, save our world, save our Pakistan.
Adam Elick joins us today in Radio Times to get our conversation started. He's a New York Times video and print correspondent. And Adam, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You have written that you really became friends with Malala and her father. Do you know how she is doing?
Well, Malala has been transferred from a military hospital in Pakistan a few days ago to a hospital in the United Kingdom in Britain. And the updates since she arrived in the UK have been quite limited. So the latest update that we have is that she is still in a coma, unconscious, in critical condition, fighting for her life, but doctors are relatively optimistic that she can make some sort of recovery. But of course, we don't know the extent of brain damage and a lot of other variables.
Have you been in conversation with her father?
I have not. He's not speaking to anyone. And in fact, his family and friends haven't been in touch with him since he arrived in the UK. So people are quite worried about him as well. I have spoken to people who were bedside with her when she was in, who were bedside with Malala when she was in Pakistan, and lots of extended family members.
When you meet them early on in your film, it is so clear that Malala and her father have a very special relationship. He talks about when she was born, falling in love with her. How did you see the two of them together?
Yeah, it's actually it's a pretty easy sentiment to identify with because I fell in love with her the day I met her too.
Really,
she's an incredibly charming young woman and or little girl when I met her first. I think she was 9 or 10 when I first met her. And, you know, their bond is, it's been portrayed by the world in the past week as the story of a young activist who just wanted to go to school. But on a personal level and on a deeper level, it's the story about a father and a daughter, because she is a direct reflection of his revolutionary zeal, his principles, his commitment. He is a man from the mountains of Swat Valley, which is a somewhat rural part of the country, closer to the border of Afghanistan than many other urban parts of the country. And, you know, he's a simple guy who's in large part self-educated, fell in love with poetry, literature, books, made his way to the biggest town, the nearest city, went to university, built a girls' school and a boys' school, became a school owner and a principal, became middle class. And he's committed his whole life to knowledge and education. How can that not directly rub off on an 11-year-old girl who spent every day of her life with her father?
Well, what's interesting, in the beginning of the film, she says, you know, she wants to go to school and she'd like to be a doctor. And clearly her father wants to be her to be a politician. Later on in the film, she says almost the same thing that he had said at the beginning of the film about wanting to be a politician in order to address the problems of her country.
Yeah, it was a great moment. I think you can even hear me chuckling in my follow-up question in the film when I say, why did you change your mind?
Yeah.
I mean, my voice cracked the moment she said that. I still remember being there. And, yeah, I mean, she's just her father is such a deep influence on her. And he follows that scene up when she changes her mind from politician, from doctor to politician. He says, you know, I want her to be a politician so she can change policy so many other girls will be easily able to get their medical degree.
How did you find Malala and her father when you made this documentary?
Well, it was my first time ever in Pakistan. It was early January 2009, and I had read a 3-paragraph blurb in a local newspaper, a Pakistani paper, that said, in 2 weeks, the Taliban have threatened to close down all schools for girls. And I couldn't believe it. And no one else was really writing about this, and it just baffled me. So I got in touch with a local Pakistani journalist who had done a lot of reporting in Swat, where the family lived. And I said, is it true? And he said, yes. And I said, how many girls will lose their education when the Taliban close down these schools? And he said, about 50,000 girls. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe it. So I asked him to get in touch with a local education activist who could then help us meet a family whose experience we could document. And I met Zaudine in a third city because it was too dangerous. Yeah, her father. And I thought that he would be a liaison to hook us up with a family who we could follow. And he showed up with Malala. And as soon as they showed up, it became obvious that they're the story.
Well, and we see there her school being shut down. We see the family has to flee for a while. We also see footage of people being beaten in the street. There's footage of dead bodies. Looks like they're tied to poles in the street. And all of this the result of the Taliban. And this was a couple of years ago. But the Taliban control over this Swat Valley?
Yeah, I mean, the Taliban ruled the Swat Valley, which, keep in mind, I mean, let's have some perspective here. 10-20 years ago, this was one of the most famous tourist attractions in Pakistan. Waterfalls and resorts dot the entire region. So the place really, changed dramatically since about 2008, 2009. The Taliban ruled entirely. Just to give you an example, the main square in the center of a city, and when I say city, I'm talking about a place with 1 million people. The main square was renamed Slaughter Square. Mm. And every morning when people drove through the center of town, not some remote place, they would see different bodies of activists and dissidents, their corpses rotting in the main square, beheaded. And it was called Slaughter Square.
The Pakistani military came in. I mean, would it be fair to say that they at least temporarily defeated the Taliban in Swat?
I think it's fair to say that they, in large part, defeated the Taliban in Swat. The military came in soon after our film came out. There was tremendous public pressure building to save Swat, as you heard in the clip you played earlier.
Yes.
And they fought a war there against an impossible enemy to defeat because they're invisible. They live amongst the people. They shave their beards. But they did kill a lot of Taliban foot soldiers and some commanders. And the war lasted, I don't remember exactly, but a few months. Malala and her family and about 1 million or 2 other people from the whole region were forced to flee so the war could be fought with, you know, firing from helicopters and things like that. And then people went back in the summer. So the whole ordeal lasted about 6 months. And my story starts with the closing of the school, follows the military in, the people out, and then the grand return of the people. And the great surprise about this tragedy, in my eyes, is the timing of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because after the war, Swat was relatively safe. I mean, it didn't look like Philadelphia. But there were no more beheadings. There were no more Slaughter Square was finished. Women could shop in the main marketplace again. Yeah, sure, there were tanks on a lot of street corners. It was still somewhat of a police state. But life was normal, relatively normal. And my first reaction when I heard about this, besides the personal and emotional devastation, was why now?
And that's a question that we do not know the answer to as of yet. We also see in the film, and we should, she was 11, 12 years old when we see her in this film. She's 14 now. But we see her talking with Ambassador Holbrook, sitting around a table, holding her own against a very powerful man.
Yeah, it was quite a scene. I mean, I was hanging out with them one day, and all of a sudden they said, you know, there's a big meeting if you want to follow us in, it could be interesting. And, you know, in my eyes, a big meeting with them meant they were going to meet up with some friends. But Zahedin, you know, he really was spending all of his free time because his business, the girls' school, had been closed down. So he basically, the family business was bankrupt. So he spent all his free time lobbying with press conferences and protests. I mean, he's a real, you know, his DNA is activism. So he was lobbying for intervention for the military to come in. And, you know, he sort of became regionally famous in his activism. He was on TV a lot and holding press conferences. And I guess Holbrooke's office had heard that there's a grassroots contingent in SWAT that is trying to change things for the better. And they invited about 10 or 12, I don't remember the exact number, of leaders from SWAT to meet with the ambassador and to voice their concerns. And they met up for about an hour, and the ambassador just listened to them. And Malala was invited, and she confronted the ambassador in what was a pretty remarkable scene and just pleaded with him to help her country. And he replies, as you all know, your country has a lot of problems.
Yeah, and I'm not sure she was totally satisfied with this answer, but she also, like her father, in her own way, became a blogger and activist. She was, I shouldn't say was, she is an outspoken critic of the Taliban. Do you think she was aware of the risks associated with being so outspoken?
Yeah, I read a quote by her the other day. It wasn't in my film. It was something she said in the past year, but she said, if they ever put a gun to my head, I will use words and tell them. And she used to always say to me, words are my sword. Mm. She was, you know, always condemning violence in all respects. But one of the other things that is sort of haunting me this week is that Zahedin and I spoke about death all the time. He's obsessed with martyrdom. In the film, he says, if I die for this cause, that would be a pretty good death. But we never spoke about Malala being the target, yeah, ever. And I asked him all the time, why are you willing to die for this? I used to even tease him and call him a crazy person. And at one point in the film, he says, you may call me a crazy person. And that's because that was one of our jokes. But we never talked about Malala. It was always the father. And I'm part of that reason is because the vast majority of people who were targeted by the Taliban, the people who were slaughtered and ended up in the square, were by and large part men. I mean, the Taliban really doesn't go after many women except for some really high-profile people. And Malala became that over time.
Well, Adam, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times and congratulate you on your documentary called Class Dismissed. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's Adam Ehrlich. His 2009 documentary, Class Dismissed, we actually put it on our Facebook page. He also tweets at A. Ehrlich. We have two guests waiting in the wings. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Camp Hill's curriculum includes music, art, drama, the sciences, life and social skills development, animal husbandry, and horticulture, hosting an open house at their Chester County campus October 27th. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Have you made a pledge of support to WHYY yet? Think of all the news, information, and entertainment that we produce 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We do that because you want it as a listener and because people just like you have made a pledge of support. You decide what the service is worth, then pick up the phone and make a pledge. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org. Thanks.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-672-4900. That's 215-672-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco, and we are talking about 14-year-old Malala Yousafzai. She was shot by a Taliban gunman. She is currently in a British hospital. She has been an outspoken supporter of girls' education, a critic of the Taliban in her country of Pakistan. She was living or is living with her family in Swat Valley, and her courage has inspired many people, and this attack has outraged much of the world community. We're learning more about Malala, and also we'll be talking about the status of girls and women in Pakistan. We have two guests waiting in the wing, but let me play actually a clip from a 2011 interview that Malala did with CNN. Let's listen.
I would like to build so many schools in this country because education is the must thing. If you don't have educated people, so the Taliban will come to your area. But if you have educated people, they will not come.
Let me introduce our two guests. Isabel Coleman, a senior fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, focusing on the Middle East and South Asia, directs the Council's Women and Foreign Policy Program. And Isabel Coleman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is Anita Weiss, professor, department head in the Department of International Studies at the University of Oregon. She was the only non-Pakistani member of the country's National Commission on the Status of Women, served on the commission's research advisory board. Anita Weiss, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
Anita, if I could begin with you, because I know you know Malala's family. And I was asking our first guest, Adam Elick, what he knew about her status. Is there anything that you can tell us?
Well, I've just gotten some text messages from friends in SWAT who have conveyed, you know, my best wishes to Ziauddin and Malala. And they're just saying that everybody there is just praying for her. I think what Adam said is just about the same update that I've received.
And Adam talked about this really extraordinary family, and I only know from what I've read and what I saw in his documentary. How do you see Malala and her family?
Well, her father, I mean, Malala has been outspoken, but especially it's really because of the bravery of her father, Ziauddin. I mean, Ziauddin, he was one of the closest contacts that I've had in the three field trips I've made in the last 3 years to SWAT. He introduced me to so many teachers, and I toured schools with him. And he's really the force behind getting the word out about how ridiculous this is that the Taliban are preventing girls from studying. But there are others as well in the Swat Valley.
And I do want to talk about those others as well. But Isabel, we're seeing some demonstrations in support of Malala. We're seeing T-shirts, you know, basically saying, I'm Malala too. Do you think or could this be some kind of a turning point in Pakistan when it comes to the status of girls and women?
Well, I think it's probably too optimistic to see it as a turning point. We've had other incidences that have been dramatic, that have caused national revulsion, that certainly raise awareness and get people out protesting and active. But then things slide back, and you're dealing with some very long-standing, deep-seated issues around women and girls that just simply aren't going to change overnight.
Well, I think it's interesting that earlier this year there was a film that got an Oscar, an Academy Award, a film called Saving Face about acid, a doctor who helps women who have had acid attacks in Pakistan. Isabel, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that's, yes, it was amazing. It was the first Academy Award that anyone from Pakistan had won, and I think it helped the film and the attention that the film got in Pakistan really helped to air the issues, helped publicize the problem, raised awareness. Again, these are issues that have been around for a very long time. They're not going to go away overnight, but the more people are engaged and understand what is going on and can see real people's stories and understand the impact and the toll that it's taking on people's lives, it definitely helps generate support for cultural change.
Do you agree with that, Anita Weiss?
Well, Yes, but it went even further than that. That film was very pivotal on facilitating the passage of a law that happened last December. I mean, of course, throwing acid on a woman's face was never legal in Pakistan. But what it did is it introduced very explicit punishments for doing it that had never existed before. And, you know, of course, just passing laws doesn't change practices, but it's a good first step.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And the film even talks about the people who were involved from a legislative perspective and from an advocacy perspective in trying to change those laws. But we know that there are many laws on the books in Pakistan that simply are not adhered to not only in rural areas, but even in urban areas. And it is something that's going to take a long time to change. But this is, you know, long-term cultural change. Things like films and television shows and mass media really, really help. And that's why the attention that Malala's case has gotten is, I think, important in that.
Anita Weiss, you had mentioned the fact that there are other women, perhaps even other teenage girls that we should know about that are working on these issues of status for women and girls in Pakistan.
Oh, absolutely. There's a long history of a women's movement in Pakistan. It was really the women's movement that was the first one to finally have a voice after Zia-ul Huq introduced these draconian laws in February of 1979. It was the women's movements that were the first ones who actually took out protests in 1981-82. But I also wanted to add that we've got to acknowledge that Pakistan itself is in the midst of a culture war, and Malala in Swat, that's the western part of the country, this is where the Pakistan Taliban and other extremist groups have had more influence. But if you go to Punjab, especially the cities of Lahore, the city of Faisalabad, and the major other cities of the country, we see female literacy rates quite high now, especially, you know, girls in school. So the idea of sending a girl to school has caught on and has gained a lot of mileage in most parts of the country. In fact, even Balochistan, people want to send their girls to school as long as they can go in a safe place. Now, the outrage in Swat, I'll try to make this very brief, has a slightly different history, because the Wali of Swat is somebody, you know, the Wali of Swat finally acceded to Swat to Pakistan in 1969, so he was no longer the king of Swat. But he had put up, and his father had started even, putting up girls' schools throughout Swat Valley. So here you have a situation where one of the few in the world where grandmothers are educated and their granddaughters are not. So you could think of this also as a crisis of rising expectations, particularly in Swat, which is one of the few parts of the western part of Pakistan where women had really enjoyed literacy historically.
And that's Anita Weiss. She's a professor, department head in the Department of International Studies at the University of Oregon, specializing in Pakistan and South Asia, published extensively on women and development concerns in that region of the world. And again, the only non-Pakistani member of the country's National Commission on the Status of Women, served on the commission's research advisory board. Isabel Coleman with us as well, senior fellow at the U.S. Foreign Policy, for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, focusing on the Middle East and South Asia, directs the Council's Women and Foreign Policy Program. She's also written extensively and had a book called Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East. And we are talking about Malala Yousafzai. That's the little Pakistani girl, the teenage girl who's now in a British hospital, having been seriously wounded when she was shot returning from school. She and her father had been activists for education and had been critics of the Taliban as well. Any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Anita, if I can go back to you, and I know there's a whole deep history of the Swat part of Pakistan, which is absolutely fascinating. But it is interesting, as you say, that for a while that was where girls could get an education. But we see about 10 years or so ago, the Taliban moves in and looking at Adam, Adam Alex's film, we see, you know, people being whipped and beaten and in these dead bodies that are left on the street as well. How is the Taliban able to exert so much control over SWAT?
That's a very good question. And the Pakistan Taliban, led by the branch led by Fazula, really started to come in about, he started his FM transmissions in 2004, really became influential late 2006, and by 2007 they were a force to reckon with in SWAT. Many people in SWAT have said to me, especially women, we were a peace-loving people. SWAT was relatively better off than other areas, than other parts in the western area of Pakistan, in part because of what Adam had said. It was widely conceived, you know, regarded as the Switzerland of Pakistan. Domestic tourists came, international tourists came. People had jobs in SWAT. Plus, of course, agriculture was the main source of income in SWAT. But it was, you know, it was orchards, it was nuts and the like, very similar to the kind of agriculture we have here in Oregon. And people said to me, we don't have a history of fighting between each other because the Wali was really the adjudicator. Hmm. But after things began to fall apart quite rapidly after 1969, and this is when people became frustrated with now long lines in the court system. I mean, fair enough, the Wali had been very paternalistic. He did, there was swift and speedy justice in SWAT because he determined cases. Most of the cases were about land, though. And, of course, that does affect women as well as men. But it was people, a woman said to me, we're still afraid. We don't understand how this all happened, and we're still afraid. And this was just a year ago when she gave me that quote. Mm-hmm. But I think the issue is that SWATI saw themselves as very religious, very peace-loving. Things in the valley were actually quite good. And so people couldn't imagine that when the Taliban came in and would transmit their message over FM radio, which people received on their cell phones, women said it was an act of modernity. I mean, how they described it to me, I see it as an act of modernity. They would listen on their cell phones to somebody teaching them about Islam, and they believed it. One woman said to me, we thought they came to teach us about Islam. They told us, don't think about fashion, don't watch television, but we stopped listening when the message turned to killing the police.
Wow. Let me get you back in on the conversation, Isabel Coleman. When we talk about the Taliban, I'm sure it means different things to whether we're talking about Afghanistan, whether we're talking about Pakistan. How do you understand what the Taliban is today?
Well, there are, of course, different groups within the Taliban and different groups operating within Pakistan. But what you have today, I mean, when Americans think of the Taliban, they think of the Afghan Taliban, which, of course, came out of Kandahar and took control of Afghanistan for a number of years. And for some of the same reasons that Anita was just talking about in Pakistan and SWAT, that you know, people were tired of the lawlessness. They were tired of nothing being adjudicated. They were tired of the civil war that was going on in Afghanistan. And the Afghan Taliban, for all of their ills, did restore some sense of law and order. Now, it was a very harsh law, and it was also a very corrupt law. You know, there were different laws for different people, in effect. And we also know of numerous cases where, of course, girls were not allowed to go to school during the Taliban years in Afghanistan, but there were senior Taliban members who secretly sent their own girls to school outside of Afghanistan and in Pakistan and in other places. And so you have today, you know, in SWAT, as Anita was describing, that the swift adjudication of law that the Taliban promised. Well, it was swift, but it was also very corrupt in many cases. There are instances of land disputes, and it was mostly around land disputes, being decided by these, you know, so-called Sharia courts, where the Taliban didn't like the outcome and overturned it. And people were looking askance at these decisions, saying, hey, we thought we were going to get something more fair, more transparent, and in fact, the Taliban here in Pakistan hasn't really delivered that. And of course, in Afghanistan, people really chafed, particularly in the cities, under this very harsh law that was imposed on them. And I think, you know, there's a sense of disillusion, whether it's, as Anita was describing, the thin end of the wedge was talking about Islam, but now it evolved into, you know, killing the police. You've seen people say, hey, I'm not sure what this is all about. It's not what I thought it was. But, of course, there is this element of fear that they've been very effective at instilling, and the shooting of Malala was an element of that. They have been, in many cases, you know, routed from the area. And in SWAT in particular, you have seen since 2009, you know, a dramatic decrease in violence and incidences there. And, you know, is this a desperate maneuver for them to get back on the radar screen? Is this a presage of more violence to come? It's hard to say at this point.
And Anita Weiss, and looking even broadly at the Taliban, but also looking at the kinds of restrictions that they have put on women and their treatment of women, why do they have such a medieval view of women?
Well, you have to remember that this, especially this faction of the Taliban, led by Fazlullah, they're not educated. They're not educated in Islam. These are people. Fazlullah used to be a cable operator, which don't think of it as high tech. It's a cable that goes across the river, and for 5 or 10 rupees, he would transport people over the river. And so I think that it was, you know, during the last decade, you know, in the 90s, looking at what the Taliban in Afghanistan had been doing, and they were coming up with their own pronouncements. Except for Fazlur Rahman, every major religious leader in Pakistan has completely, totally distanced themselves from the SWAT Taliban. And even Fazlur Rahman, the head of the Jamiat Ulama-e-Islam, is not a fan. I've heard from people in SWAT and elsewhere that even the main faction of the Taliban in Pakistan distance themselves from the SWAT faction because they think that they're just so out there and it's not Islamic.
But we're almost having a break here, but the thought that this will hurt their reputation?
Well, here you have a situation in Pakistan with such a complete breakdown of law and order. The state is not enforcing anything. It really goes to what's happening in the central government in Pakistan and also the provincial government. Mm-hmm. People said to me when I was in SWAT most recently, January, February of this year, they said, we can't even get a sewer fixed because the provincial government is only concerned about what is happening in Peshawar, the provincial capital, and Mardan, where the chief minister is from. Mm-hmm. Nobody even pays attention to SWAT. But on the other hand, you have so many NGOs trying to do development work in SWAT, but they're each doing it separate from the other. There's no coordination of anything. Well, it's a very frustrating situation.
And we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Anita Weiss and Isabel Coleman. We are talking about Pakistan. We're talking about the attack on 14-year-old Malala Yousafzai, and we'll be back after this short break. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, the Fellowship for the Performing Arts, presenting The Screwtape Letters, a theatrical adaptation of the C.S. Lewis novel, at the Merriam Theatre on October 19th and 20th. Tickets at screwtapeonstage.com.
Delaware Valley College supports WHYY and presents the Social Business Future Conference, Friday, November 9th, on the college campus in Doylestown, PA. This full-day business conference and planning retreat is designed for executive leaders, HR professionals, marketers, educators, corporate trainers, and business owners looking to move their organizations beyond the basics of social media. Full information and registration is online at thesocialbusinessfuture.com.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Have you made a pledge of support to WHYY yet? Think of all the news, information, and entertainment that we produce 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We do that because you want it as a listener and because people just like you have made a pledge of support. You decide what the service is worth, then pick up the phone and make a pledge. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, United Healthcare, offering a range of plans for Philadelphia area businesses and access to a national network of over 690,000 doctors, along with a local network right here in Philadelphia. More information at uhctogether.com/Philly.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Anita Weiss and Isabel Coleman about the status of girls and women in Pakistan, and also talking about 14-year-old Malala Yousafzai. She's in a British hospital recovering from wounds that she received when she was shot by allegedly a Taliban gunman when she was coming home from school in Pakistan. She and her father have been outspoken supporters of girls' education. Let me play another short clip, a 2011 interview that she did on CNN. Let's listen to this.
I have rights. I have the right of education. I have the right to play. I have the right to sing. I have the right to talk. I have the right to go to market. I have the right to speak up.
And again, that's Malala Yousafzai talking on CNN last year. Isabel Coleman, if I can go back to you and thinking about your book, Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East. Is feminism and Islam, can they go hand in hand?
Well, they certainly do go hand in hand in places of the world where women are very conscious of their faith and of their rights within their faith and appeal to their faith to promote their rights. And you can call it any number of things. Some call it Islamic feminism or Muslim feminism, but they're really pointing to religious texts, to the Quran, to the Hadiths, to other sources to say, you know, we have a right, you know, to go to school. We have a right to say who we marry. We have a right to inherit property. We have a right to have a premarital contract that enables us to continue employment or to continue our education, whatever it may say that they deem important. And all of these things are noted in the Quran, and they point to this as a way to gain rights that they currently don't have, that are culturally not the norm for women in parts of the world.
And Anita, is it religion sort of up against culture? Is that how you see it? Then we'll get to some callers.
In some places, yes, but I just want to pick up on what Isabel just said. There are movements around the world. For example, in Malaysia, Sisters in Islam. There's a women's reading group I hear of in Syria. And also there's groups of women in Pakistan that they're saying that Islam in the past was always interpreted through the lens of patriarchy. It's about time we go back to the Quran itself and we come up with our own understanding of what is actually in this book that we can live our lives by. Asma Barless has also written on this, and she's in the United States. She's a professor in the U.S., but it's a very exciting time. I mean, Fatima Mernissi, the Moroccan sociologist, had written once, and I think this is a very powerful statement she wrote. She said, "The great challenge now confronting Muslim women is to envision a future instead of just growing old." Mm. And you heard that in Malala's recording just now from 2011. How do you envision a future? But it is happening around the world, and it is happening in most parts of Pakistan. Pakistan today is a very different country for women and their rights than when I first went there over 30 years ago.
Would you agree with that, Isabel?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's driving this quiet revolution is rising female literacy rates. And
yes.
Anita referred to that already in places like Lahore and Punjab, but you do see it across around the world. I mean, even in a country like Afghanistan, where a whole generation lost their education, today you have more girls in school than ever before in that country's history. And, you know, that's something that will have a long-term impact for that country. And women are more engaged. They're more connected. I mean, the first time I was in Afghanistan was more than a decade ago. There was no electricity in the country. Today, every little village I go to, some woman has a cell phone, and they're connected in ways that they never have been previously. This is true in Pakistan, of course, also. And you see women now with greater literacy, with greater connectivity to the outside world. They are aware of, through soap operas, which are very popular, whether they're Turkish soap operas or Bollywood soap operas, of how women, other Muslim women, live their lives that are quite different from their life. And they ask questions, and they are being able, they can read texts for themselves. They can read the Quran for themselves increasingly. And so you do see women pushing back and saying, hey, you know, that's not what it says.
But so then I understand what both of you just said. Then how are we supposed to understand the shooting of Malala Yousafzai? Anita?
Well, if I can, I think that it's really important that we understand that Pakistan has been going through a lot of transitions, as have many other parts of what we might call the third world. And there's this blowback of these culture wars that are happening. Going to SWAT today, on the one hand, the government of Pakistan has just started the air flights to bring tourists back to SWAT. So now you have tourists coming, but yet you have people still afraid that the Taliban could make inroads. The biggest issue I had heard was if the economy fails, they were the only employers. But I think it's more than that. Mm. It's about who's controlling culture, who is determining what we do. I mean, one thing you didn't raise, but kind of in my mind goes hand in hand with this, is the Taliban's reluctance to allow people to get polio inoculations. They just killed somebody in Quetta yesterday, a Pakistani who was administering, you know, the serum so children wouldn't get polio. I've heard from many people in SWAT, though, that the Taliban leaders there had their own children inoculated. Mm. So it's like fighting against the West, fighting against change, but change is happening, and it's happening quickly. And the empowerment that women in Pakistan have been experiencing, especially the last 6 years when Pervez Musharraf overturned the worst part of the draconian laws that Zia-ul-Haq had passed. I mean, in 2006, it finally was that a woman in Pakistan who was raped could no longer be imprisoned because adultery and adultery without consent was put back into the penal code adultery was put back into the penal code. So since 2006, it was the women's movement that was able to push forward and finally get that bill changed. There's been so many other bills to promote women's empowerment since then, and that is just reflective of an overall movement towards bringing about this change. And I completely agree with what Isabel said. I've published on this. It's educated women who are bringing about the most important changes. Still going to have these irredentist elements that are going to be fighting tooth and nail against that change. But I think that, I mean, I'd like to say hopefully they're on the way out. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, it seems like a long way to go, Isabel, in terms of if the goal is equality. There's a long way to go.
I think equity more than equality.
Equity. Sorry. Go ahead, Isabel. Go ahead.
There is a long way to go, and these culture wars are not going to end anytime soon. In fact, in some places, they will no doubt become even more intense. And you've seen the culture wars play out very brutally in a country like Pakistan and Afghanistan, but they're going on in Saudi, in Yemen, all over the Middle East. I was in Tunisia last week, and a young woman there was raped by the police. She went to the police. Other police said that she had been raped, and she is now being accused of indecency, which, you know, strikes at the heart of what Anita was talking about earlier with the Hudud laws in Pakistan. And this is Tunisia, a very modern, progressive country in the scheme of things, and it's, I think Tunisians themselves are shocked that this could be happening in their own country. And, these battles that are going on, women are very much on the front line of those battles because their issues are so tangible. And I think it goes back to the identity of the Taliban. You know, I think Anita's very right to say, you know, it's not that there's some religious notion that they're trying to follow. For the most part, the Taliban in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, they are illiterate. They're not familiar with the Quran themselves, but they have some identity that they have around their harsh interpretation and how they have to impose it on others. And, you know, that's not going to go away anytime soon.
Let me get, we have to figure out some little phone problems that we have there. We're going to get someone back on the line. It looks like Anita Weiss staying with us. And,
oh, no, I'm here.
Okay,
I'm
that's
here.
Good. That's good. I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Mark from Reading to join us. And Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Thanks for your patience.
Yeah, my question is, are you sort of forcing Western American culture on someone else's culture? We, you know, had those discussions with the female circumcision. I'm not necessarily endorsing anything, but at some point, I mean, what would America do if the Pakistani people talked about the way American women are being treated? That, you know, I heard all your discussions, but at some point, where is our culture being forced on theirs? That's my question.
Mark, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Anita Weiss, is the West forcing
that
culture?
Not at all. I mean, it's Pakistanis at the vanguard, for example, of female education. I mean, you heard the words of Malala Yousafzai. But this is an area, remember, I had said before, it's an area where female literacy had been avidly promoted by the last Wali of Swat. And this had nothing to do with the West whatsoever. It's that I think you could see it in Swat more even as the crisis of rising expectations. I said before, it's an area where grandmothers are educated and granddaughters are not. And so it had, you know, in terms of talking about women's empowerment and women's rights, it's a very Pakistan-driven movement. But again, there's a pushback from those who want, it's less religious than cultural, but they don't see the fine lines between where culture ends and religion begins, and it becomes all kind of melded together.
And Isabel, sounds like you're back on the line with a better phone line there. But is there a gender gap? I was looking at something like the 2010 global gender gap, finding that the workforce in Pakistan, only 20% of the workforce is female. Is that about right?
I think that's about right, although, you know, we're talking about the formal workforce and not the informal workforce. There are a lot of women who work in the informal economy as shopkeepers, as, you know, they have their own little, you know, stall that they have outside of their home, or they're working in the fields and raising some chickens. I mean, all sorts of different things that are not captured in those statistics, but that feels about right to me.
And actually, I think it's a little higher than that, though, now.
Okay.
I think it is actually in just about, you know, nearly 30%, 29%, because women also, and that's, as Isabel said, in the formal sectors of the labor force. Women in urban areas engage in a lot of piecework manufacturing and are dependent, of course, on a middleman. And in rural areas, everybody except the most elite do work in the field.
And that's Anita Weiss. She's the department head in the Department of International Studies at the University of Oregon. And Isabel Coleman is a senior fellow for U.S. foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we are talking about Pakistan and the status of women and girls and what happened to a 14-year-old teenage girl named Malala Yousafzai. I'm Artie Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me go back, and we only have a couple of minutes to kind of pull things all together here. But to you, Isabel, we've been focusing largely on making sure that women and girls are educated. Can you make the economic argument that if you have an educated female workforce, it's good for the economy? It's good for the whole country.
Oh, well, that's an easy case to make, Marty. We have tons of data on that, and it's, you know, the first level of education, getting girls through primary school and through secondary school, has such tangible payoffs for their own lives and for their children's lives in terms of improved health outcomes, improved educational outcomes for their children. Educated mothers are much more likely to send both their own sons and daughters to school. The vector to the next generation is still very much through the mother. And then, of course, there's the economic side of it, too, that women with education are more likely to earn income, to be productive, and to contribute to their family and their whole community and to the GNP of the country. I mean, we know this on a macro level. Countries like China that have invested heavily in female education have significantly benefited from it, as has the United States. I mean, look at a recent McKinsey report that looks at 25% of our GDP in the last 20 years has come from gains with female productivity. So, you know, that's not a hard case to make. I just want to quickly go back to your comment about workforce participation, because you do have to remember that when women are educated, there's a lag still between rising levels of female education and workforce participation. There are many barriers that prevent women from working in the formal economy, from getting jobs with companies and the things that are in the formal economy. And there are cultural barriers, there are institutional structural barriers, you know, lack of transportation, lack of childcare, all these types of things. And you do see that lag, and, you know, that lag can last a generation or more. We had that lag in our own country. You see the lag in countries where there is rising female education. But that shouldn't be your only measure of women's contribution from higher education. It really is a spillover across, you know, their family and really directly to the next generation.
Well, we could go on, but we have to end our discussion. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Isabel Coleman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
She's Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Anita Weiss, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And she's head of the Department of International Studies at the University of Oregon. We began our conversation with New York Times video and print correspondent Adam Ellick and talking about his 2009 documentary called Class Dismissed. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be right back.